Hello, welcome to KUOW's Speakers Forum. I'm your host, John O'Brien. In this extra episode, you hear of situations where a book comes to a writer in a torrent. In this talk, writer Andre Assimon tells such a story about his well-loved novel, Call Me By Your Name, published in 2007. Assimon's book came to renewed acclaim and some controversy when the film adaptation became a phenomenon last year. The acclaim, the movie was nominated for multiple awards and won an Academy Award for screenwriter James Ivory. The controversy, some raised age of consent issues about the relationship between 17-year-old Elio and his lover, 24-year-old Oliver. Andre Assimon is a distinguished professor at the Graduate Center of City University of New York. He was interviewed by Dave Wheeler of Shelf Awareness at the packed to overflowing Elliott Bay Book Company reading room on February 26th. They moved the Q&A upstairs so everybody could listen. Please note, this recording contains some themes of an adult nature.
Hello, Andre.
Hello, everybody.
Thank you all for joining us. It's really exciting to be here. I'm very excited to be here. How are you feeling, Andre?
I'm very excited to be here.
You've got an incredibly rich body of work, all the different aspects of it. But I think right now there's kind of one thing on everybody's mind, peaches. But to start off with, I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about your journey with this story since it was published in 2007. How has your relationship with the story changed?
Steady one. it's a good relationship, except I forget that this book exists until, you know, they made a film of it, because you always think of the next book. Your heart is where you are challenged the most and where you suffer the most. And this was a very easy book to write. It was done, as you probably all know by now, in 3 months, 3.5 months actually, and it came to me. It was sort of an inspiration, something that never happens. Usually, I struggle with every single sentence, every single paragraph, every page. If I write a page a day, I'm really, really lucky. It hasn't happened in a long time, and never did. But this just wrote itself within a week. I had 30 pages. I sent them to a friend of mine in France. He looked at them and he said, "My God, what are you doing? You're disgusting." And of course, because he didn't expect anything like that. And I said, what do you think we should do? He says, "Well, you satisfy yourself however you want, and we'll see what happens." But of course, the story is that eventually I went to my agent and she said, I've written the novel that I was supposed to write. No, I said, "I've written the novel." And she said, "Oh, finally you've written that particular novel that I was on contract with for." And then I said, "No, I didn't write this novel. I wrote another novel." That's typical, Andre. So she says, "Okay, send it to me and I'll read it," that sort of thing. And she called me the next morning and she said, "I read it." I said, "You read the whole thing?" I said, "Well, are you shocked? Do you want us to abandon it?" She says, "No, I want to sell it." So anyway, so it's been alive since then. It's never disappeared. It's always been doing well. And eventually, there was interest in the movie, in making a movie. But as you probably all know, making a movie takes forever. And the degree of interest that people have is so ebullient that you always say, "Oh, they're making a major movie out of it." And of course, the next thing you know, "No, Andre, it's going to be a little indie, okay?" And I said, "Fine, I'll take an indie. I don't care." They certainly paid for it as if it were an indie. So, but it was... But no, I'm being nasty. Actually, the producer was is a wonderful person. He didn't have to sell me because I wanted a movie. Everybody wants a movie. And anyway, but it took about 8 years of director and changing directors, changing screenplays, and changing actors. Every actor wanted to do it, and then they had to do something else. So eventually, James Ivory came on board. I said, "Okay, James, he's for real. He's not going to BS you." And then they said Luca Guadagnino is going to be doing the actual directing. I said, "That's even better, because Luca is a direct inheritor of Luchino Visconti, as far as I'm concerned. And I wanted somebody of that kind of sort of sensitivity and sensibility. And so then they started, as my agent would say, Andre, don't get your hopes up. Until they start rolling, nothing is real. So eventually they were scoping for places. I said, okay, that's a good size. He says, no, it's nothing. So eventually they found a place, and it wasn't a place. There was no beach. But I said, it doesn't matter, does it? They can fake the beach. He said, no, we're not going to fake the beach. There's not going to be any water. I said, oh, fine, who cares, okay? And so they did that, and it worked fine. For those of you who've seen the movie, you know that you don't need a beach, you don't need boats, you don't need any of the stuff, and it all happens naturally. So anyway, I saw the movie in Berlin, and I loved it. I was totally surprised by it. And I've seen it quite a few times afterwards.
I have two.
Yeah. Well, and anyway, so that's it. It's been a long sort of journey, to use that word. Yeah. But it's been a very good one. And I think that it happens usually once in one's lifetime.
Yeah. I do think you maybe skipped over something. You have a cameo in this film. And how did that
We skipped
how did
over that,
come that
intentionally. No, it's a cameo because basically... they said, do you want to come to see how the movie is being filmed? I said, sure, I'd love to see that. So I flew to Italy, and I was going to stay in a hotel that same day. And they said, no, the director wants you on the set. Said, okay, fine, I'll follow orders. So I went on the set, and sure enough, they were sort of acting out a scene that I have had trouble writing. It was the only scene that was difficult to write. And I said, fine, I'm glad. I said, by the way, we would like you to play a part. I said, maybe the cook or something. And they said, no, we want you to be one of those two guys. I said, oh, God. I said, fine, I'll do anything you want. They said, we have a suit ready and that sort of thing. I said, what kind of suit is it? It's a suit that's slightly ridiculous. I mean, everybody knew it wasn't going to be a ridiculous job. I said, I can't learn any lines. And they said, you don't have to learn anything at all. Just say whatever comes to mind. And I did. I said whatever came to my mind. And it didn't matter. And then that was it.
Well, I know when I first saw the movie and first read the book, it was very delightful to read a story of two men in love that didn't involve a lot of trauma. There's a lot of trauma when it comes to two men in love that gets perpetuated in a lot of different stories. But we don't necessarily see that in Call Me By Your Name, and we also don't necessarily see you describing Oliver and Elio in terms like gay or bisexual. You spend a lot of time describing their desire, but stay away from terms like gay and bisexual, and even love. I've read in some other interviews you purposefully avoid the language like that.
But I avoid anything that's sort of declarative, and that is obvious, and that is going to foreground something. And I mean, I don't even describe them. I don't give you the name of the town where all this happens. I just hate that stuff, you know. So-and-so walked into the room. He wore a black hat. He had a mustache that was growing too long. And he had a big chin and sort of bulging eyes. Who cares? You know, I hate that sort of stuff. So what I prefer to see is sort of the degree of, and I've said this, the degree of energy and of spite that a character can sort of radiate. And I prefer that because then you really have a sense of what kind of an individual it is. Humor, irony, spite, sometimes even a touch of boldness and cruelty. Anything that sort of suggests there's something emanating from them as opposed to just the face, as if the face says anything. And so I avoided the big terms. I avoided the word gay. It doesn't appear once. I didn't want to deal with your basic plot line of the gay kid being attacked and bullied and made fun of by other people. I didn't want there to be a fight because they were gay. I didn't want anything like that. I didn't want the parents to police the relationship. What else didn't I want? I didn't want many things. Essentially, I also didn't want to bring up AIDS because I thought that that was going to skew the story away from just the brute desire that each one felt. I wanted to stay with that very difficult idea, which is, how do we desire someone when we desire them? What is it that we want from them? What is it that we don't want to want? Because there's also that in every desire. What is it that we're ashamed of of sort of confiding. It has nothing to do with gayness, I thought. It had to do with the fact that when you desire someone, you're just basically put in a position of inferiority. You want something from them. You're afraid they won't give it to you. They won't listen to you. They'll put you in your place. They make you feel like a sick and twisted person. And of course, that's what anybody can do that to you. And I'm sure some of us have experienced that in the past. And we're better for it because we've been humiliated enough times as it is already anyway. And I've been humiliated, and somebody in this room knows how deeply humiliated I was once upon in my life. And had nothing to do with sex, by the way. but there are things in our lives. So when you want someone, and I wanted to sort of microscopically and lyrically as well, almost elegiacally, try to focus on this thing that works its way inside of us and won't let go. And I thought that as a writer, if there is a mission as a writer, it's the one of capturing those things that everybody in this room knows so well. I wasn't telling you anything you didn't already know, but just to not to map it out as if there's a chart out there that allows you to go from A to B to C to D. It was more like, what is the territory like? What is this geography like of this landscape that has sort of underground rivers and floating islands? Everything shifts around all the time. And I believe that sexuality especially is sort of a floating phenomenon that has no sort of defined place. The thing about sexuality that we don't always admit is that there are days where you are not sexual at all. And I'm not going to ask people to raise their hands. But where we say, how come I'm not thinking about this today? Well, I always think of it. How come I'm not today? And yesterday was no better. I mean, it's nothing to do with age. It's that sometimes even the desire, sometimes you find yourself desiring everyone. And sometimes you desire absolutely no one. And sometimes, as happens, it's happened in my life sometimes, you say, why did I do that last night? Why did we do this? And how do I leave tactfully? Anyway.
I think you captured that that scariness and that the confusion of desire sometimes in Alio at such an interesting age of 17. He's trying to be a man, but then he also feels that shame of being, forget the word you used, but being told that he's not good enough, that he's not desired back. And I was wondering how you honed in on Alio's voice to tell this story of adolescent ambivalence and desire.
Well, I was in my early 50s when I wrote this book. And to be honest with you, I don't recall my adolescence at all. I don't want to remember it. There was nothing about it that I want to relive. But I do think, and this is where I tend to correct people, I don't think that the desire that a man at the age of 50 feels is in any way different from the desires that a kid feels. I think that's the same degree of obsession, of sort of unrelenting obsession. It's the same all the time. It's always been with me. Maybe I'm the only person who feels this way. Thank you. Thank you. People are shaking their heads. You're not. I'm with you. Okay. But it's the fact that we are always desiring. So I didn't have to sort of torture myself and say, what is it that a boy who's 17 feels like when I can't even remember what I felt like? Because it hasn't changed. It's the same. I'm the same person that I was when I was 12. And I've just finished writing last year a book about a boy who's 12 years old who falls in love with a man who's 24 years old. And he doesn't know anything about sex. So I was eliminating this from the formula altogether so that we just analyze, not as a doctor would, but basically analyze what are the energies that a child feels for an adult when he doesn't know a thing about sex. And if you go back to your years when you didn't know, of course some of you already knew when you were 3, from the looks of your faces, yes, you did. No, but I mean, I didn't know something. I knew nothing about sex at the age of 11. I knew nothing. And there was, I didn't even suspect there was anything to suspect, but my mind went into certain areas that were almost libidinal and were probably dirty, to use that word. And I had no idea why my mind was always drifting in those areas. And I always, I've said this before, if I were never told what sex was, I would have come up with something. But it would not have been the thing that brings babies or makes people happy together. It would have been something totally weird. It would have involved trees, plants, peaches, maybe. But I have no idea. I mean, because if you think about it, what would I have come up with if my mother or my aunt or whatever in class or the writing on the bathroom wall didn't tell you what sex was? You would have come up with something that was totally, totally sick. But that's what would have been natural for you. Now, thank God we rechanneled that sickness and I've left trees alone, I promise you. But anyway, that's so to go back to your question, I didn't want to label anything. Not the place, not the people, not anything. I just wanted to get rid of that, just to focus on what is it that Elio, that wonderful kid, feels for Oliver and how he fights it and how he incubates it and at the same time he fights it. He makes fun of himself. He makes fun of Oliver. He wants Oliver to die so that he can get rid of him. If I'm not going to get rid of you, then just die somehow or get paralyzed so that I can take care of you for the rest of my life. You know, it's one of those weird things that went on his mind. And I think we all think things of that nature. Yeah. And then we sort of smuggle them away. We sort of choke them because that's embarrassing. I should never have thought that.
One thing that you write about that tends to raise a lot of eyebrows are the age differences between your characters. And this is Call Me By Your Name, the book you just mentioned that you finished writing. It also comes up in Enigma Variations. What do you think it is that attracts us to someone of so much older, so much younger than us?
I don't know what the answer is. I think some of us, there was a woman who was much older than I was at the time, and I think we had a very, what you might put, tumultuous but also meaningful relationship. And I liked that she was older. I didn't have to, of course I was smarter than she was, there was no question. Ooh. No, but I mean, I needed somebody who was older because somehow people my age didn't do it for me. They were too young, I thought. And I needed somebody older who also had more experience and would maybe even teach me things. Mm-hmm. And there's a wonderful scene in the Enigma Variation where the older man says, you know, you shouldn't be looking at people this way. Mm-hmm. Because he stares right at him and he says, you shouldn't look at people this way. Oh, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to stare. He says, I mean, are you're old enough to know what that kind of staring means, or aren't you? Because he's not. He doesn't, but he knows he's crossed the line. And when you think about it, in certain moments in our lives, we've crossed lines. And it could happen in a bar, it could happen in a living room, whatever. But you cross a line and it's sort of a moment where you know you're doing it. And you don't like yourself for doing it, and that the other person can either repulse you, or sort of push you away, or the other person can actually help you speak what it is that you were really saying. And what happens in that scene with Oliver and Elio when they're in front of the war monument is that Oliver helps him to say something that he didn't even know he was going to say that day. He had absolutely no plan on saying that you know, I know nothing. What do you mean you don't know nothing? You know, that sort of thing. The voice that I always imagined Oliver having, that particular voice. What things? That sort of thing. And so in a way, it... why was I saying this? I have lost my thread.
Well, let's maybe shift gears a little bit, because talking about desire and things we can't necessarily express with words, classical music is actually very consistent in your work, and it comes up at Elio's a Musician, and Enigma Variations is named after Edward Elgar's compositions, And I wonder what draws you to writing about these particular pieces of music. What draws you to include them in the stories you want to tell?
I'm not sure that they play a significant role, but they're a form of a signpost. And I think it goes with the sensibility that I'm trying to convey to the reader and to myself. I mean, it just formalizes that sensibility. It says Bach's piece has no meaning here, but it just tells you what kind of a person this character is, that he wants to play this piece by Bach. And in my work, there's always been classical music, and it's usually chamber music or solo piano or whatever. And I like that because at the same time, it also keeps the bar a bit high in the sense that it keeps it slightly elitist. In other words, you got to know this stuff. This stuff is not incidental. It's important. It's beautiful. It's timeless. And we're dealing sometimes, I'd like to think, in my work, that maybe we're dealing with a bit of timeless stuff here. It's not just all incidental, that at the end of the day, we're back to whatever it is, February 26, 2018. No, there's something that transcends the normal day-to-day stuff, the nuts and bolts of life. And I think classical music plays a bit of that role. It says there's something far greater going on here. These are people with significant sensibilities, and they have high tastes. And I think that most readers, if they don't know the piece, they might, all you have to do is go to YouTube and check out, what's this piece? Oh, that, yeah, that's not bad, you know.
Yeah, I'm on Spotify a lot when I'm reading your books. Are you a musician yourself?
No, I don't play an instrument. I couldn't even read music. But I do this, I listen to this stuff all the time. I can't listen to it when I'm working, but
I was going
like,
to ask.
No, I do like to listen to chamber music. Is what I truly love, and I love it. And I have it on shuffle too, if you want to know.
You talked about timelessness, and that is, time is something that comes up a lot in your work, particularly memory. And I know you have a significant history with Proust. But one of the more invisible layers of Call Me By Your Name is that the whole story is being told from Elio's older perspective on his past. And I was reading one of your essays in Alibis earlier this week, and you talk about the how memoirists rearrange memories as they please. And I wonder if that should color the way we read Elio's take on the events of Call Me By Your Name, if he's rearranging things to remind himself of his own desire.
That's a good question. I don't think he rearranges things because the book intended to be chaotic. In other words, as I was saying, it's not a chronology of how he developed. First he saw this, then he did this, then that, then this. It doesn't progress that way. It's all over the place. And I wanted it to be chaotic in that way, so that, because that's how we sort of nurture our emotions. There's no planned course. So in a way, that's how I reacted to it. On the other hand, memory does change many things. But I don't think that in Elio's case, his mind, whatever he forgot, turned out to be totally incidental. We don't know what he forgot. Mm-hmm. In fact, he doesn't remember many things, and we don't know what he remembers. We don't even know what happens at the end of the story. If you think, you know, I don't know what happened. And people say, what are they going to do next? I say, I don't know. the point is that his memory, because it's he's writing it from the past, from the future, in looking into the past. And he is nostalgic, as would happen whenever we remember the past. But at the same time, he doesn't give you an outline of what it was like. He just spills it all over the place. And so that there is this sense of disorder completely. And that's how memory works, mm-hmm. I think. Whatever he doesn't remember, we don't know what it is.
It sort of feels like he's actually putting his father's advice into practice, the advice his father gives him at the end of cherishing the moments, even though they may be hurt after the affair is over. And how, what inspired that conversation with the father? It's very understanding and encouraging and moving, and I think it's something that a lot of us latch on to, something we would have liked to have heard our parents tell us at some point.
Well, I mean, if you're deeply shaken by an experience and you're very hurt, and your parents see you sort of pouting away and being very sad, there are parents who say, well, you know, they didn't raise the issue with me. I don't have to talk about it. They will talk to me about it if they want to. There's that kind of sort of not intrusive parenthood, which I refuse to practice. I'm the most intrusive parent in the world. I'm intrusive with my friends. What happened then afterwards? Well, I don't think I should. Yeah, tell me. Okay. I always like to know those little sordid details of life, which everybody's embarrassed of. See, you're smiling. You're the same way, okay? but basically, the father speech, it's a father who decides he's going to take over. He's not going to let this go away. And having begun to speak, as happened between Elio and Oliver, they begin to speak, and then something pushes them to the next step. And the father said, you know, let me say something more, and it will clear the air. You know, go ahead, Dad. there's that sense of Elio is scared because he thinks, oh, they know, they must know, surely they know. And there's a sense of the father is going to actually have the talk, but it's not a consolation talk. Mm-hmm. Things will get better, son. You just wait. You know, you'll meet somebody else. They'll be better. You know, that sort of thing. That's not the kind of speech that the father is going to give. It would have been so tempting to write that. I wanted a father who would say, you know what? This is the bad moment for you. I know it is. And at night, it's going to be even worse because you're going to miss him really badly. But don't fight it. Don't sort of smother this thing. Let it go where it needs to go. Because at least the next time you'll find someone else, you won't have already chopped a part of your heart away. And then he says that wonderful thing. Says, you know what? I could have had what you had, or I came close to having what you had, but I never did. And something stood in the way. Now, I think that is heroic of the father, because the father is obviously a straight guy who is married and has a son, etc. And at the same time, he's saying, you know what? This image you have of me is not exactly the right one. And let me open up and tell you more about myself. And so I wanted that. And there was an impulse on my part when I was writing that scene, which was an easy speech to write because it came sort of from the heart, if that is a thing that one does. But it was also, I wanted to push it further and see what else was there that he could say. And I didn't want to stop writing that. And then I said, no, he's just said it. Enough already. Mm-hmm. And what I do love in the film, and it makes any writer very happy, is that the father's speech is exactly taken out of the book and just transcribed onto the film. The problem is that I never now can read out loud in the public that speech because Michael Stolberg does it so much better.
It is a really fantastic speech in the film and on the page. And the exchange with the father and Elio, when he admits that he's never had a connection quite like he saw in Elio and Oliver, it really changed my perspective on his relationship with his wife, that he doesn't consider their connection anything remotely similar to the love he saw between Elio and Oliver,
well,
the desire
yeah,
between
them.
You
know, he's been married for quite a while, too. You know, give the guy a break.
Sure.
I mean, they've been together for ages, and so something may have sort of changed. But the immediacy of the one thing that I was so scared that they would do in the film and they didn't was that you would have a moment in which the mother and the father know about what's going on. I wanted it to come. I'm sure the mother knows, but you don't see them knowing. You don't mm-hmm. see them actively knowing, and I wanted the speech to come out as a complete surprise. so that you're surprised as a reader, you're surprised as a viewer, and certainly Elio is totally surprised. There's a moment in which they're playing footsies under the table in the novel, and Oliver says, you know, just don't do that. I'm sure he knows. And so they didn't want to push it. And so the parents did know, but the mother was so tactful. She sees him almost exploding with tears, and she doesn't say anything. She just drives him back, and then she lets him. But the father has the scene, and you never see the mother saying, are you going to talk to him about this thing? How gosh would that have been? You know, I mean, like, it would make it so, it would make it very Hollywood-y. Yeah, I'll take care of it. I'll talk to him about it. It was, ooh.
One more question? Okay. Were there things about the film that surprised you that you hadn't thought were in the book, but there they were on the screen? Yeah. And
there was one in particular, and I think it's what makes the film the kind of genius that it is. The director told me that he was going to include in the film, the film was going to close with a scene of Elio's face crying. And I was upset. Not upset, just unhappy with that, because I said, I had misgivings. A scene where the guy cries, it's just too maudlin. And I was going at it, and I was expecting this scene where he's going to cry. He's going to cry. No, not yet. He's going to cry now. No, not yet. I was not happy with it. And then I saw the scene, and I thought it's a work of art in and of itself, because as he's sort of smiling and weeping and not weeping and trying to, so he's almost like recapitulating the whole story of their summer together. And as he's doing that, the music is in the background. And suddenly, at some point, as he's just staring at this thing, and it's going on and on, suddenly the credits come up. And never in any film I've ever seen have the credits meant anything to me. This is where you stand up and you go. But in essence, the credits was also a way of spelling the end of something. It meant not just the movie's over, guys. It was more like, this is the end of their relationship. There's a finality in the moment when you see credit. So that the act of seeing a credit was itself significant and was part of the film. And this is why one should never stand up when you see the credits come up. From now on, I always wait till the end. That was my lesson. But I love the ending. And that was not in the book. And I told the director, I told him, you know what, the ending of your film was so much better than the ending of my book. And in a way, if I could have written that scene, I would have done it. But you can't do that in a novel. You need to do other things. And it also teaches you, I've seen movies all my life, but I needed to know what is it that something that happens on screen takes something that's on paper and redoes it in some other form so that the emotional component is maintained, whether it's on paper or on the film. It may be a different image altogether, but the emotional, the amplitude of the emotion at that point is sort of maintained. It's rescued and savored.
I agree that the credits are worth staying for.
Just see the credits. Forget
the
movie.
The credits. Come for the peaches, stay for the credits.
That's good. That's very good.
All right.
It's like take the cannoli and leave the guns or whatever it is.
You all made it up here. That's fabulous. I already see one hand over here. So let's just get rolling.
Yes.
Your experience with multilingualism and how do you choose to incorporate it into your
I don't know if you know, but I was born in Alexandria, Egypt, where essentially everybody speaks at least four languages. So that was a natural thing. In the book, there was only Italian, and there was only Italian and English. But there was there were French actors that came on the scene, and French was sort of became a natural language in the family. And since they all spoke French, why not have them speak French? And so that is what happened. And what it does, on top of everything else, it justifies this kind of pluri-universe that we're dealing with. Many languages, many orientations, many identities, many everything. And I love that. The more, the better. Anyway, so that's, I don't know if that answers your question.
I was wondering what you intended the phrase, I'll call you, call me by your name and I'll call you by mine, to me, because I know it speaks about their intimacy and how they love each other so much that they not only saw themselves in one another, but they saw each other as themselves. Did you intend for it to have any other meaning besides that?
No, that was exactly the meaning that I wanted. In other words, you are me and I am you, and at this point you can even take my name. And I don't know where I am and where we begin and where the other ends. And there should not be a beginning and an end. It was the ultimate form of sort of what I call sort of identity ductility. You sort of, by osmosis, you become the other person.
Yes.
I'd like to know, in your creative process, did you ever think about ending it a different way?
Yes. Yes, I did. In fact, the book ended in manuscript form when the two of them are sitting in the bar and they're having drinks in the college town where Oliver teaches. And I said, that's it. That's a good ending, yeah? And I thought about it. No, he should invite him to his house. Okay, he's going to invite him to his house. And at that point, Elio is going to come out and say, I can't come to your house. In other words, it still hurts. I wanted to do that. And then I said, okay, we can end it now. And then I said, no, there has to be another meeting. And I wanted the last meeting to be where Oliver this time comes to the house. They've already had contact, so the room is ready. It's going to be the same room. And essentially, Elio fears the worst, that he's going to leave. But there's absolutely no reason to believe that he's going to leave. And I left it there. At that point, I said, okay, enough already. I've tinkered enough with the ending. But endings are, for me, the most difficult thing to do because you're supposed to resolve something that is fundamentally insoluble. You can't. And so I was forcing an ending that was nevertheless written in the conditional mood. In other words, it's not now past or present or future. It's just conditional.
How reliable of a narrator is Elio in all of his contradictions throughout the book?
I think he's reliable enough. He's a good narrator, if it's a first-person narrator, always makes a fool of himself. He intentionally makes mistakes so that, among other reasons, so that you get to like him more. Oh, he's fallible. He's not the omniscient kind, the guy who always knew better. He does not know. He makes mistakes. He catches himself wanting things that he's embarrassed to want. I mean, when he goes up into the bedroom and puts on Oliver's bathing suit, that's a bold thing to do. And God forbid he should get caught. What are you doing with my bathing suit? I mean, it's that sort of thing. So he's unreliable in the sense that he makes mistakes, but he's not the kind of Nabokovian narrator who is, I'm an unreliable narrator, I'm giving you facts that I might withdraw in a minute. That kind of stuff, which I've hated, by the way. I've always hated that kind of writing.
Is there a relationship between your writing style and film?
And there's an article in the American Scholar?
No, you talked about my night
of loss. Oh, yes, thank you. Oh, sorry. I was, you know, I have bad memory. I'm unreliable that way. No, I think Eric Rohmer is still one of my favorite movie directors because he's so unbearably intelligent, just intelligent. And what he has is there's a wonderful scene in which a man and a woman are sitting in the same bedroom, and she's basically asking him to sleep with her. And he says, no, I'm a good Catholic, and it really goes against my principles, so I can't sleep with you, but it's snowing outside, so I'm going to spend the night here, but I'll wrap a blanket around me so that I won't be tempted. Of course, he is tempted, and I won't give it away, but the conversation that they have lasts about 40 minutes. Which is a wonderful instance of movie making that is, yeah, it influenced me in the sense that I love people who are together and speak intelligently about their emotions and about what happens to them and what they want and what they're afraid of. I love that. And so, yes, there is an influence. Who asked the question? Yes, you did. Yes, thank you.
In film, the father gave this magnificent that obviously deliberate? Is that what you wanted and how he should come across that? Just, I mean, at that point, I wanted him to be my father.
Well, that's the idea. no, I mean, I wanted the scene exactly to play itself out that way. I don't think you'd have to be a stupid filmmaker to do it in any other way. I mean, that was the only avenue open, I think. But I do want a parent to be inspired by that. But that's not why I wrote the scene. But there's no mission statement who am I to teach people what to say? But it is an inspiration. In other words, if you have a son or you have a child that is gay, or if you are gay and you're trying to speak to your parents, you know, give them the book. that speech that the father makes, I think you should read it.
Go ahead.
Thank you. First of all, thank you so much for your lovely gift. I came all the way from California, and your novel has touched me on so many levels as a gay man, as a Jewish man, and as someone who came out to my father in 1984 when I was 16.
Wow.
I just want to thank you in a San Clemente multi-layered kind of way. Thank you. So here's my question. My question is, let's fast forward at the end of the novel. Let's go forward 15 years, and keeping in the trajectory of Elio and Oliver's character, where would they be right now? What would they be doing?
What's the trajectory of Elio and Oliver
based now?
I'm
sorry, based on the trajectory of their characters, what would they be doing right now in 2018?
Where would they be in 2018?
2018. You mean after 1983 or whatever? I don't know. I would like to think that the children have grown up, that Oliver's children have grown up. They're boorish kids, as you probably imagine. And they're in med school or become lawyers or something. And his wife is no longer interesting. And he is still in love with Elio. But you don't know what happens to Elio either, you know? So I think there is a sense that, you know, in life, and I'm sure many of you know this, that whatever you had in the past, if you try to resurrect it many years later, it may not be rescued that way. You can't do that. Time has already had an effect. It has altered things. Things have happened to you that the other person never witnessed and cannot catch up to. So it's easy for me to say I would love them to be together again in that house where they met and basically have careers of some sort where they're not partners. I would love to think that. Is it possible? I don't know. And maybe we should ask Luca Guadagnino what he has in store. Thank you.
Thank you, Andre.
Thank you all. Thank you all so much.
Thanks for streaming this extra episode of Speakers Forum from KUOW 94.9 Seattle. Andre Assaman is a distinguished professor at the Graduate Center of City University of New York. He was interviewed by Dave Wheeler of Shelf Awareness at the Elliott Bay Book Company Reading Room on February 26th. Subscribe to our podcast when you get a chance. We appreciate your clicks and comments. Tune in again soon.